Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. Today, we're going way back to ancient Israel, specifically to the events, the really dramatic events in 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10.
Okay.
Picking up right after a military commander named Jehu has just orchestrated the downfall of King Joram and that notorious Queen Jezebel.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of political upheaval, lots of religious clashes, and some seriously intense power struggles, you know, like Game of Thrones level. So get ready. Because it's going to be a wild ride. And we're going to explore this question together. Was Jehu a divinely appointed instrument of God's justice? Or something maybe a little more complex?
Yeah, it's fascinating. The text kind of presents Jehu as this almost mythical figure, a warrior king anointed by God to, like, purge the land of evil. But, you know, as you dig a little deeper, you start to see some cracks in that heroic facade.
Right, right. Let's start at the beginning with Jehu's rise to power. He sends this really bold letter to the leaders in Samaria, the capital city. And it's not a request. You know, this is a demand.
Oh, yeah.
And it really sets the tone for his entire reign.
Right. He's not messing around at all. He knows he needs to establish his authority, and quickly and decisively, because he just pulled off this incredible coup. But, you know, his position is super precarious. He makes a wrong move, and boom, full-blown rebellion.
It's a huge gamble.
Yeah.
So he plays this high-stakes game of almost like psychological warfare. Because in his letter, he basically dares the leaders to defy him, knowing that, I mean, come on, the memory of Joram and Jezebel's violent ends are still pretty fresh in everyone's minds.
Exactly. It's a calculated risk for sure, but it pays off big time. The leaders, I mean, they're terrified, and they quickly cave to Jehu's demands, even offering to put one of Joram's sons on the throne if that's what he wants. But Jehu has much bigger plans.
He's not messing around. He doesn't just want the throne. He wants to dismantle the existing power structure, like completely wipe it out, and then remake the kingdom in his own image.
Yeah.
And that's where things start to get really interesting and, let's be honest, a bit disturbing.
Right. Jehu demands the heads of all the royal princes. And it's chilling, you know, because it almost echoes, it's a chilling echo of Queen Jezebel's own brutal tactics. Remember, she was notorious for using fear and violence to maintain her grip on power.
Right. It's almost this fascinating parallel. You have Jehu, supposedly this righteous reformer, but he's resorting to the same methods as the very evil he claims to be eradicating.
Right.
It makes you wonder, is he really that different from the regime he overthrew?
Yeah, that's a question that the text really wants us to wrestle with. On the one hand, we see Jehu justifying his actions. He's saying that he's carrying out God's will. He even invokes the prophet Elijah, who prophesied the downfall of Ahab's house. But on the other hand, he kind of seems to be going beyond exceeding the boundaries of those prophecies.
Right. He goes on this rampage, killing everyone. I mean, everyone, even remotely connected to Ahab. His advisors, his friends, even the priests who serve Baal. It's like he's just a whirlwind of destruction.
Yeah.
Leaving this trail of blood in his wake.
And at this point, you start to see this disconnect between Jehu's actions and the divine mandates that he's claiming to be following. God had commanded the destruction of Ahab's direct descendants, yes, but there's no explicit command to wipe out the entire extended family and network.
Right. It's almost like he's taking things to a whole new level. He's blurring the lines between divine justice and personal vendetta. And it raises an important question for us as we're reading this. How do we discern the true will of God in these really complex situations, especially when, you know, human ambition and thirst for power get mixed in?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And then that question becomes even more pertinent when we look at Jehu's actions towards Ahaziah's relatives.
Yeah.
Because they were traveling to Jezreel, totally unaware of the coup, essentially innocent bystanders, you know, caught in the crossfire.
Right.
And Jehu doesn't hesitate. He orders them all killed. 42 people. God hadn't said anything about Ahaziah or his family. This just seems like it's purely Jehu's decision, driven by, I don't know, what do you think is driving him at this point?
I mean, it's hard to say for sure, but you can't ignore the possibility that his initial zeal for God's will has kind of become, you know, intertwined with this lust for power and a taste for violence. He's crossed a line, and it seems like there's no turning back.
Wow. Okay. And to make things even more complicated, we had this really strange encounter between Jehu and Jehonadab, the leader of the Rechabites.
Yeah.
And they were known for their really strict adherence to God's law, living a simple life and rejecting the trappings of worldly power.
Yeah. The Rechabites were almost like the conscience of the nation, you know, like a living embodiment of the covenant between God and Israel.
And here's Jehonadab, this incredibly devout figure, hopping into Jehu's chariot and praising his, quote, zeal for the Lord. It's a powerful endorsement, but it also feels incredibly ironic given the bloodshed we've just witnessed.
Right. It's almost like Jehu's using Jehonadab's piety as a shield, as a way to deflect criticism and legitimize his actions that have become increasingly brutal.
This encounter adds another layer of complexity to Jehu's character. And it raises even more questions about his motivations. Is he a sincere religious reformer? A cunning manipulator? Or perhaps, and this is, I think, the most intriguing, a messy mix of both.
Yeah, it's a puzzle that we're going to continue to unpack as we dive deeper into Jehu's story. But before we move on to the next chapter of his reign, there's one more detail we need to consider. And this detail kind of hits at the tragic consequences of Jehu's actions.
Oh, what's that?
So about a century after all these events, the prophet Hosea, he writes about Jehu's reign. And let's just say he doesn't exactly paint a rosy picture. He condemns Jehu's bloodlust, particularly the massacre at Jezreel, and calls it a stain on the nation. And this is really important. He says that this stain will ultimately lead to the downfall of Jehu's entire dynasty.
So even though Jehu believed that he was acting on God's behalf, his methods and the extent of his violence ultimately earned him a rather grim legacy. It makes you wonder, is violence ever truly justified, even in the name of a higher purpose? I don't know. What do you think?
That's a profound question. And I think it's one that we as listeners need to ponder as we continue to explore the complexities of Jehu's story. Because ultimately, this isn't just a story about a king and his kingdom. It's a story about the human condition, you know, our capacity for good and evil, and the really difficult choices we face when we try to create a more just and righteous world.
It's a story that's both fascinating and unsettling.
Yeah.
And I'm already hooked, but we've only just scratched the surface. Stay tuned, because in part two, we'll be delving into Jehu's campaign to eliminate Baal worship in Samaria. Mm. And trust me, it's a story you won't want to miss.
Yeah.
Okay, so we left off with Jehu. You know, he's consolidating his power, but facing some pretty serious questions about his methods.
Right.
Now, he's turning his attention to Samaria, like the heart of the kingdom and the epicenter of that Baal worship.
Yeah, you're right. This is where Ahab and Jezebel really, they solidified Baal worship. Like, they built temples there. They installed priests. They were essentially trying to make it like the main religion. Mm-hmm. So for Jehu, getting rid of Baal worship in Samaria, it's about more than just like religion. It's about erasing their legacy and then establishing his own authority.
And so it sounds like he's setting up this like epic clash between Yahweh, the God of Israel, and Baal. But instead of this big divine showdown, like with lightning bolts and earthquakes, Jehu opts for something, I don't know, a little more strategic.
Absolutely. We see that cleverness that we discussed earlier, you know, it comes into play again. He doesn't just march into Samaria with an army and start tearing down temples. No, no, no. He's much more cunning than that.
So what does he do? What's his game plan?
He sends out a proclamation throughout the land. And get this, he announces this huge assembly for Baal in Samaria.
Oh, wow.
And he invites everyone, all the worshipers, the prophets, the priests, everyone come participate in this big religious festival.
Hold on, wait a minute. So he's pretending to be pro-Baal, like he's a secret devotee.
Exactly, exactly. He plays the role perfectly, making sure everyone believes that he's even more zealous in his devotion to Baal than Ahab or Jezebel ever were. I mean, it's brilliant, maybe a little deceptive, but... man, a brilliant tactic.
It's next level manipulation. Why go through all this trouble? Why not just round up the Baal worshippers and just, you know, be done with it?
Because Jehu wants to make sure he roots out every single last trace of Baal worship. Mm-hmm. He knows that if he just uses brute force, some people will inevitably, like, hide. They'll go underground and keep their beliefs secret. So he needs to draw them out in the open.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So this elaborate religious festival is actually a trap.
Yeah.
He's luring them into this false sense of security so he can just eliminate them all at once.
Precisely. And the text really emphasizes how big, like, the scale of this gathering. It says that the Temple of Baal was so packed, people were crammed in from wall to wall.
Oh, wow.
Imagine that scene, like, the anticipation, the fervor, and then, bam, the betrayal.
Oh, man. That's chilling. So everyone's gathered in the temple, you know, expecting this huge celebration of Baal. What happens next?
Jehu, ever the showman, he makes this huge entrance.
Yeah.
But before the festivities can even begin, he does something really deliberate. He makes sure that there are no worshipers of Yahweh mixed in with the crowd.
So he wants to be absolutely certain that he's only targeting the followers of Baal.
Yeah.
I mean, that adds this whole other chilling sense of premeditation that we were just talking about. This isn't like a spur-of-the-moment act of violence. This is calculated. This is cold-blooded.
Yes. And once he's confirmed that everyone in the temple is a Baal worshiper, he gives the signal. And his soldiers, who have been waiting outside, you know, hidden, they storm the temple and they slaughter everyone inside. No one escapes.
It's a brutal massacre. And it raises some serious ethical questions. Even if we consider the context of ancient warfare and religious conflict, Jehu might have believed that he was purging the land of idolatry. But man, the sheer scale of violence is so hard to reconcile with, like the idea of divine justice.
That's right. It's the stark reminder that even those who claim to act on God's behalf can be capable of these really horrific acts. But Jehu isn't finished yet. He doesn't just stop with the massacre.
Right. So what else does he do?
He orders the destruction of the temple itself. They smash the sacred pillars. They tear down the altars. And they even, and this is crazy, they even turn the site into a latrine, like the ultimate act of desecration.
So he's not just trying to eradicate Baal worship. He's trying to completely, like, obliterate it, any memory of it, to humiliate and erase it from, you know, the collective consciousness of the people.
Exactly. He wants to send a clear message. You abandon Yahweh and embrace foreign gods, this is what happens to you. You have to wonder, though, how do you think the people of Israel would have reacted to all this?
I'd imagine there would have been a mix of reactions.
Yeah.
Fear, relief, and maybe even some who were horrified by the extent of the violence. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, after all, these were their neighbors, their friends, maybe even family members who were slaughtered.
It's a sobering thought, and it kind of sets the stage for the next chapter of Jehu's reign, where he faces these new challenges, both internal and external, and those challenges are going to test his leadership and ultimately shape his legacy. Remember, despite all these decisive actions, he's inherited a kingdom that's weakened by internal strife, corruption, and this looming threat of this huge empire to the east, the Assyrians.
The Assyrians? Oh, yeah, that's right. We haven't talked about them yet. So who are they, and what role do they play in this story?
The Assyrians, man, they were a major force in the ancient Near East. They were known for their military might, and I mean, they were ruthless in expanding their empire.
Wow.
And for the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, they represented a constant threat, you know, like a storm gathering on the horizon.
So Jehu has managed to eliminate his internal rivals, but now he has to deal with this huge external threat. How does he handle it?
Well, that's what we're going to explore in the final part of our deep dive. We'll see how Jehu navigates this complex geopolitical landscape, and we'll examine the long-term consequences of his actions. Stay tuned.
Okay, so we're back, and this is the final chapter in our deep dive into Jehu's reign. And he's purged the kingdom, he's gotten rid of Baal worship, and now he has this, you know, huge threat, this looming threat from the Assyrians. I feel like we've reached a turning point, you know?
Definitely. Jehu's at a crossroads. I mean, he's had some really significant victories, but at a huge cost. And now he's got to figure out how to secure his kingdom, not just from those internal rivals that he had, but against this massive external force that, I mean, honestly, they could just crush him like that.
So how does he approach this? Does he try to rally his forces and fight back against the Assyrians?
Well, you'd expect that from a warrior king like Jehu, right? But the text tells us something different. Remember, the Assyrians were this military superpower. I mean, they were famous for being ruthless and efficient in warfare. So taking them on directly, I mean, that would have been a huge gamble. And one that Jehu, I think, despite all his boldness, wasn't willing to take.
So what does he do? Does he try to negotiate some sort of peace treaty?
Not really. The text kind of indicates that Jehu just chose to submit. He basically became a vassal king to the Assyrian Empire, paying them tribute, acknowledging their authority over his kingdom.
Wow. That's pretty humbling, especially for someone who started out, you know, this unstoppable force, wiping out dynasties, overthrowing religious orders. I mean, it feels almost tragic to see this really powerful figure kind of brought low by forces beyond his control.
It does, doesn't it? But it also kind of reveals like this deeper truth about power. It's often fleeting and contingent on things that you can't always control. I mean, Jehu, he might have conquered those internal enemies, but he couldn't overcome the geopolitics of his time. It's like he was playing a game with rules set by, you know, a much bigger player.
So what does that mean for his legacy? I mean, does this submission to the Assyrians tarnish his reputation as this divinely appointed king?
It's really hard to say how the people of Israel saw it. I mean, some might have seen it as a sign of weakness, a betrayal of that covenant with God. But others might have seen it as, you know, a necessary evil, a pragmatic move when facing such overwhelming odds.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that even way back then, leaders had to make these really hard choices, balancing their ideals with, political realities. It just adds another layer of complexity to Jehu's story.
For sure. Jehu's reign, I mean, it was a whirlwind. Coups, massacres, religious reforms, and then finally, this forced submission to this foreign power. It's like you can't just say he was a hero or a villain. He's a product of his time, driven by ambition and religious zeal. He really wanted to leave his mark on history.
It's been so interesting exploring his story. We've encountered political intrigue, religious fervor, violence, and then ultimately, this reminder that human power has limits.
And it's remarkable to me how, even though this all happened so long ago, it still resonates with us today. It makes us think about the nature of power, the complexities of faith, and how to make hard choices in a world filled with violence and uncertainty.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the world of King Jehu, we encourage you to keep thinking about these questions, explore the biblical text, do some of your own research, delve into the historical context, and think about how these ancient stories, how they shed light on our own lives and the world around us. Until next time, keep diving deep.